All right. So once again, thanks for coming. We got a really, really good group of sessions. We did this in Philadelphia on Saturday, and it worked out. I mean, it exceeded my expectations. You know, let me give you a little history as to why we're doing this. This whole DevReady thing, it's a branding that we're trying to build on now on niche topics. So instead of something like the Firestarter, how many people attended my WCF Firestarter several months ago? All right, so that one was about technology. You know, WCF is a technology. It's a Microsoft technology. It's an awesome technology, and we needed a whole day to really get you up to speed on it. The DevReady events are going to be more technique, should I say, technique and style. You know, MVVM is not a Microsoft technology. It's a pattern. It's an architectural pattern, and I want to show you how to use it correctly, especially because it goes hand in hand with a couple of Microsoft technologies, and without it, you'd probably be struggling quite a bit. So that's what we're going to try to do with these DevReady events, and I'll put this out there now so you can think about it. I'd love to solicit some ideas for other kind of niche topics that you guys think would be good and beneficial for you to spend an entire day on. And it doesn't have to be the entire day concentrating specifically on that. Some of the sessions can go off a little on a tangent as long as they stick around the general context. And that's what we did here. We got the introduction to XAML. How many people are new to XAML technologies, like WPF and Silverlight? Okay, very good. Now, those people that are raised your the ones that are not new, give me a hand for WPF. Now, give me a hand for Silverlight. Almost 50-50, with WPF being a little more, which surprises me. Usually, the Silverlight people a little more. The ones that are new to this kind of stuff, would you say that you've been a little intimidated by the technology and you haven't taken the leap yet? Would that be a fair assessment?
Yes.
You would. Okay, I'm glad you're honest. Developers are usually not honest, okay? You're all lying scumbags. Watch. Let me prove this to you. How many people here are total beginners to development? One guy. Some people are lying. They are. I just know it. Just by historical statistics, you know? But the problem with XAML technologies, and keep in mind, I'm going to call it XAML. And when I say XAML, I'm talking about WPF and Silverlight. Everything that you're going to see today, unless I'm specific, is going to apply to both technologies. I use WPF in my sessions, and you're going to see that Danny and Seth are both going to use Silverlight in their sessions. So you're going to get two and two, plus this intro, which I'm using WPF on, but it's going to apply equally. So XAML technologies are more intimidating than they are complex. And the main reason for that is that it's a total paradigm shift in how we develop. As a matter of fact, a lot of people tend to think that web developers are a little more comfortable with XAML than Windows developers because it's markup-based. That's actually a pretty fair statement, especially when it comes to doing stuff like layout. But the intimidation factor is much higher than the complexity factor. When you start tearing this technology apart and seeing exactly how it works and how it does what it does, it's not that complicated, especially the one topic that seems to drive people completely away from wanting to learn it because of fear, and that is the data binding. You know, Windows has data binding, web has data binding, or kind of hacked data binding, but nothing data binds like XAML. It is extremely rich, and the fact that it's so rich sometimes implies that it is very complex. That's why it's so rich, because it's a complicated animal, and it really isn't. So I hope that by the end of this session, the next so-and-so 75 minutes, you're going to have a real clear understanding, and I want you to tell me if that's true or not, okay? And if you don't, or in the middle of what I'm talking about, I'm not explaining it well, please stop me, okay? This is going to be a pretty informal schedule. We're going to try to do 75-minute sessions. If I go 5-10 minutes over on one of them, we'll recover. We'll either take 5 minutes away from lunch, or the next speaker will sacrifice. You know, what Seth talks about is really unimportant, so he'll be happy to sacrifice his time for me. Actually, with Seth being here, I want to really point this out and emphasize it, even though Peter already did. This event could not have occurred without Seth's company, Developer Express. I really wanted to put this event together. It was something that me and Peter had discussed a while ago, before me and Danny discussed it. It was originally, he's my DE, so I usually go to Peter first for these things. And the problem that we were having was budget. There was just a finite number of events that Microsoft lets the DEs throw on a yearly basis. If there was an infinite number, I would throw these things every couple of weeks. I work from home. I don't got to call in with a stupid excuse to my boss, right? But we just didn't have the money, so I had to go externally for the money. And DevExpress was, I mean, they were the first ones on my list because I'm very biased. I have a very strong relationship with this company. I've done business with them, and I have a very personal relationship with them as well. So they're really the first people that I went to try to find a good sponsor for this. and they jumped at the opportunity. Especially since normally, like when you sponsor a code camp or a conference or something, you know, you get a booth and you got to sit outside and kind of talk to people on break. Here, we're giving them an entire session. So the fifth session for this event is going to be done by Seth. It's going to be DevExpress MBVM centric, which means he's going to talk about Prism. He's going to introduce you to Prism. Anybody here Prism? Has anybody used Prism? Ah, see? One guy. All right. So Prism, and two guys. So Prism is what used to be known as the composite application block for WPS. It was rebranded as Prism. Anybody use the composite application block for Windows Forms back when it was around? One guy? So you're gonna learn what composite applications are, which is applications that are made up of different separate modules that are very, very loosely coupled to each other. And Prism allows you to do that. And Seth is going to teach you all about that stuff. And he's going to do it using DevExpress Control. And they have a superior suite with a superb group of WPF and XAML controls. In fact, DevExpress had the very, very first Silverlight grid that ever came out, affectionately called AG Grid. Anybody want to take a shot in the dark as to why it's called AG Grid? The periodic table of the elements, symbol for silver. Nobody picked up on it. One guy? Come on. Thank you very much. If I had gifts to give, you'd get one. But I don't. Total geek. Chemistry 101, people. So if silver is AG, what say you? Get it? What say you? I just made that up. But it is gold. You're absolutely right. All right, so the fourth session of the day, which is going to be Danny's, is going to be pretty interesting because that one, Danny, you know, my three sessions introduce you to technique and style and architecture and pattern. Their stuff kind of brings it together in more real world. Danny's going to show you Windows Phone 7 stuff using MBVM, like a real world application. And Seth's going to do the same thing. He's actually building a little application. If I know Seth, he builds everything from scratch. Contrary to my own recommendation, a fear of writing the wrong code, he builds all his code from scratch. The main reason for that is because it gives him a chance to show off yet another DevExpress product. Everybody here has heard of CodeRush. So Seth knows probably three times as much about CodeRush as I do because he's got Mark Miller standing over his shoulder screaming at him when he doesn't use it. So you're going to get to see a lot of CodeRush at play. And hopefully by the end of the day, we'll be giving something away, right? So some licenses will be given away. Of what and how many are yet to be determined. It depends how good you guys are. And you got to be here to win. So if you get bored and you walk out of the room, you're SOL. All right, so I'm going to go for this session. I'm going to go through the slides real quick and just talk to you a little bit. And then we're going to get out of the slides and go into code and stay in code the entire time, okay? But I want you to start forming a visualization in your head while I'm talking before I show you code. It's going to give you, if your brain's able to do this, it's going to give you much better understanding when I do put this in code. Because XAML and building XAML applications, it's all about visualizing the markup. It's not like Windows Forms where everything's drag and drop. And when you drag and drop in Windows Forms, the code that actually builds this behind the scenes, what you guys may know is the designer.ts file or designer.db file, it's really hidden away. Even though you can access it, how many of us really go into that file and make a manual change? It rarely happens. And you don't want to do that because that file constantly evolves as you continue to drag and drop more stuff on the form. So in XAML, it's very different. In XAML, the what builds the screen is the XAML markup, and you need to be very intimate with it. And anybody that tells you, well, you should just use Blend or you should just use the Visual Designer and don't ever worry about going into the XAML, they're full of it. That's just a really, really bad piece of advice. If you want to learn how to program WPF and Silverlight, you got to learn how XAML works, and you have to be able and willing to just dive in and write XAML code. And you're going to see that it's not complicated, but it takes a certain amount of visualization. So I'm going to introduce you to that, and we're going to talk about controls and panels. Panels are very important. Panels are controls, but panels is how things get laid out in XAML. And it's a very, very different layout concept than what it is in Windows Forms. In Windows Forms, everything is drag and drop and absolute positioning, meaning wherever you drag the control and leave it, that's where the control stays, unless you use the famous little anchor thing that completely, you know, drove VideoSoft out of business. Everybody remember VideoSoft from the VBX days? They're the one that first created the resize panel. Well, when .NET came out and it came out with the anchor and dock and stuff, it drove them out of business. And that's where it stays. It's pretty much static. XAML layout is very different. And the fact it's more web-like than it is Windows-like. Now, in building controls and panels, you start creating a XAML hierarchy, and that hierarchy becomes something known as the visual tree, and that's going to be a very important term, especially when I get into data binding. We'll talk a little about namespaces, but I'm not going to dwell on namespaces too much because we're going to constantly revisit namespaces throughout the next two or three sessions afterwards, and then we're going to definitely dive into binding. That's going to be the big one because that's the one that you're going to need to understand in order to continue through the MVVM sessions. How many people here consider themselves new to MVVM? Excellent. Good. The more people, the better. Anybody know what MVVM stands for?
Model View View Model.
But the misleading part is that it's really a three-letter acronym, not a four-letter. It's not a what's it called when one thing is spelled the same way backwards or forwards? There you go. Who said it? If I had a gift, I would give one to you as well. See, I have none, but I'm going to tease you like this. But you gift recipients, you know who you are now, right? These two guys right here, Mr. Periodic Table and Mr. Palindrome over there, the Ogopogo guy. All right, so MVVM is Model View View Model, and that third part is not two words, it's one word. That third piece is called a view model. I just want to make sure everybody understands that because I actually didn't. When I first got introduced to this pattern, like, Jesus Christ, yet another one? We're on this ever-ending quest to put as many things after the letters MV as we can possibly find, or as many things before the words driven development as we can possibly find. And I am here today to add one more thing to driven development. I'm going to show you what I call state-driven development, which is how I describe model view view model. So you're going to learn what these pieces are in the next hour, in the hour after this. The model, the view, and then the view model. So it's not a view and a model. So XAML is yet another X language, right? How many of these do we have? After XML came XSL and then XSD and then, my God, it's all over the place. Even Workflow has got this thing called XOML, X-O-M-L, which is the language behind Workflow, Windows Workflow. So this is extensibility application markup language, and it really is a new way to think about desktop programming because it's completely markup-based. How many web developers here? Okay, and Windows developers? I do this on purpose. Okay, now we almost got a 50-50 there. A lot of times I'll get, you know, let's say in a room this big, 10 people, web developers, 15 people, Windows developers. What the hell do the rest of you guys do? Java? Seriously, it happens that way. It's just, you know, people are afraid to put their hands up. How many people in this room have a body temperature of about 98.5 degrees? You see what I mean? So, you know, little tricks that I play on the crowd to keep them on their toes. And I'll be messing with this guy right here significantly over the course of the next 7 hours. I do that all the time. I've had that chair up to 20 miles an hour down the DeVry University in Philly Code Camp with him on it. And I'm in the back yelling, "I'm top of the world." All right, so it's kind of the reason I did that little poll is because XAML is kind of a hybrid between Windows Forms and HTML because it's an HTML way of writing a Windows application. Things are built using a markup language, hierarchy like HTML is, and more importantly, they're positioned that way. And the positioning, the layout stuff is going to be really, really important. Inherently, right out of the box, both XAML products, and when I say both XAML products, I'm obviously talking about WPF and Silverlight, have a code behind model. This is identical to the model that we use in Windows Forms, where we really don't call it a code behind, but that's essentially what it is, which is viewing the code that's behind that Windows form. On the web, we do call it a code behind. In fact, the attribute on the ASPX page at the top of the page directive says code behind equals, unless you're using the code beside model, which is just a euphemism for code behind. Views are another term I want to get you used to, because we use the term forms in Windows Forms, we use the term page in the web, and by default, WPF and Silverlight use the term window. What I'm going to do is that I'm just going to use the term view because we're here to learn about MVVM, so let's talk about it in MVVM terms, okay? The view is going to be, in XAML applications, it would be the window or the user control. But either way, it's going to be a view, something that has XAML on it that's going to represent visuality on the screen. On the web, this would be a page, and on a Windows form, it would be a form, but we're just going to call it a view. And a view is made up of controls within controls, within controls, within controls. So it's actually a tree of things. And we use these panels for layout. There's a number of panels that are available, probably five or six. I'm going to talk about three of them extensively, the grid, the static panel and the dock panel. And the first two are the ones that I'm really, really going to be focused on, especially the first one, the grid. Those are the ones you're going to use most. Controls are all tagged. So just like ASP.NET web forms where you drag, where you say ASP colon text box, that gives you a text box on a web page, but it also corresponds to a text box control, a text box class in your code behind. So you can address that class from your code behind, and you could even do something like put a placeholder control on a web page and then fill it dynamically by instantiating label controls and text box controls and button controls. So every tag in ASP.NET has got a corresponding object. XAML's no different. If I drop a label control or type a label tag or a text box tag or a grid tag or a text block or anything, any tag at all in XAML, all has a corresponding object. And all of the properties of that object, so all the properties of these objects are in XAML represented as attributes. Once again, the same as ASP.NET. That's why I say there's kind of a kinship here, and people that are web developers tend to be a little up right away, a little more comfortable than people that are Windows developers because things look the same in almost every markup language. So your XAML tag is your control, which is represented by an object in the code behind, and every attribute of that XAML tag are the properties of this control. In XAML controls, all of those attributes or properties, in this case I can use that term interchangeably, have a common base, and that's going to become important when we later talk about binding. All of these properties, they're called dependency properties. So when you write custom controls, it's a little more difficult than just creating a class that has a bunch of properties. This will work. You can write a control that way. And I'm not going to be writing custom controls here. But to write what's called dependency properties takes a little more work, but it's work that's worth it because you want these properties to be managed by WPF or by Silverlight, by the XAML parser, and you want them to be available for full-blown binding capability. And they have to be this dependency-type property. It's called dependency property to be binding compatible. So out of the box, all the properties that we're going to be dealing with are they have this capability. Here's a really important part about XAML technologies as far as content is concerned. A lot of you are used to the web and Windows where you have, for example, a label or a text box, and you have a text property. And what you can put in that text property, usually you put string. But like the button's got a text property. The label's got a text property. Text box, same thing. The is checked, or I'm sorry, the checkbox has two properties that have different content. One of them is one that's called is checked that determines the check condition of the checkbox. And then the other one's called caption. So see, that's a little different for every control. In XAML, it's different. In XAML, every control is able to house content. And what that content can be is anything. So it's a very, very different thing than Windows Forms and ASP and Web Forms or even MVC. If I put a button on a XAML page, the contents of that button can be text, but they could also be an entire hierarchy of other controls. And sure as hell, that button will display everything that you put inside of it. As stupid as it sounds, you can put a whole list box or a whole grid inside a button as button content. And the beauty of it is that you have full functional capability of those content. If it's a list box with 10 items in it that can be scrolled and that the items can be selected on, but it's housed as content inside a button, that's exactly what you will see on the screen. So some of these things have no practical purpose whatsoever. And if I ever see one of you put a button on there with a list box inside, I'm probably going to blog about you by full name. But the important thing to take from this is that there's a clean separation between appearance and behavior, which is something that's been attempted in the past by this company and by other companies. It has never been completely successful, and it's successful now. And it's a very interesting concept, the difference between appearance and behavior, because these things are truly decoupled. In WPF or in Silverlight, I can literally take a list box, which, just think about the functionality of a list box. It can contain items in it, and if the items exceed the height of the list box, what do you get automatically? You get the scroll bar, right? And you can scroll, and you can press your items, and they'll highlight. That's functionality that we all expect in a list box, right? Well, in XAML, not only can I take that list box like that, but I can change the way the list box displays its data so that it's horizontal instead of vertically. And now the behavior of it is exactly the same. I can still click on the items and scroll them, but now they're going to be laid out a little differently. Then I can take that list box, and I can rotate it 45 degrees and change its skew so it's 30 degrees in, kind of like a vanishing point. Now, nobody will ever program a list box like this, but it makes for a really cool demo, because now you got this weird list box that looks like it's kind of headed down a road, and as the top item looks like very thin because it's at a point, and the bottom item is very thick, so it's almost a three-dimensional list box. So it's completely warped out of shape visually. However, if you can manage to get your mouse on the scroll bar, you will be able to scroll it, and you will be able to select the items in there. So the behavior of it has not changed. And this is the case for every single XAML element, and it was an incredible achievement by the architect that put this together. It took a little tweaking on the implementation side for them to get it just right, but the architecture behind it was brilliant. User control usage is much more common in XAML applications than they are in Windows Forms. So you can get away with writing Windows Forms applications for a long, long time without ever writing a user control. Everything is just Windows, Windows, Windows. In XAML applications, especially when using MVVM, as you'll see in some of my demos, things get more containment-based because there is no visual inheritance. So the idea of creating a form that derives from another form, like we did in Windows, does not exist. So because we don't have visual inheritance, applications tend to be more containment-based, where there's a master window with several regions on it, and user controls are swapped in and out of these regions. There's a lot more containment going on. Now, here comes layout. Layout can be a little bit of a confusing animal, but number one, I want to tell you, every view must have a top-level panel. So you're going to see when I create a new window, it's always going to start out with the grid control. Now, it's important for me to say that when I say grid control, I'm not talking about a data grid, and that needs to be said because most people, you say grid, they hear data grid, just like you say lock, they hear deadlock. I'm talking about a grid panel, which is more akin to an HTML table. It's a grid panel that's used for laying controls out. The data grid is a data grid on its own. And my own opinion, the data grid that comes with WPF is not the greatest thing in the world. It's very elementary, and it's a real eyesore. That's where you really do look to companies like DevExpress for really good data grid representation. Different panels offer different capabilities. I'm going to be talking about the grid panel, which is the most powerful one, because the grid panel allows you to use drag-and-drop capability, and using marginal positioning, which I'll explain when I get to the code, you can let things stay where they were dropped, basically having no real row and column definition, or you can have predetermined row and column definition, so you can have things grow dynamically in size or in positioning. And then you got something like the stack panel. The stack panel is a panel that's designed for you to just shove stuff into it, and it's just going to display it in a stack, either horizontally or vertically. You can choose the orientation. So each of those two panels are meant to contain information, but they display it a little differently. There's also the dock panel, where you can put things in it and tell it, I want to dock it to the left, dock it to the right, the top, bottom, or the fill area, which is in the center. You get this automatic docking capability just with the panel. There's something called a canvas panel. You can write a custom panel. I'm going to show you at the end of this talk, I'm going to show you a list box demonstration that a lady, I forgot her name, but she's the lead architect in charge of WPF binding at Microsoft, and she wrote a demo that'll blow your mind. Beautiful. And that has to do with customizing a list box. So I just told you about the grid. We're just going to get through this. All right, let's talk about the visual tree. I've just told you XAML is a very, very visual technology, and I'm not talking about the final product. I'm talking about the actual markup that you're writing. You have to be able to visualize it. So controls have content in them. That right there implies a certain beginning of a hierarchy. Those controls need to be inside a panel to be laid out properly. I just added to that hierarchy, so picture that in your mind, okay? When you write a XAML application, your view will be comprised of controls within controls, controls within a panel. Those controls have content. That content could be some more controls. The controls within that content can actually be laid out themselves, which means you'll require some other kind of panel. And in doing so, at the end of the day, when you're done with this view, you end up with literally this indention hierarchy. That indention hierarchy is referred to as the visual tree. And that's going to be an important term, because when it comes to binding, you're going to see that I'm able to bind anything to anything. And when a binding source is set at a specific tag level, any of these tag levels in my visual tree can have a binding source set to it. In the world of MVVM, we usually set it at the top level, which is the window level. But I can set it at any level. And the binding is going to be good for that control and down its visual tree until I set it otherwise down that visual tree. So if I have a visual tree that looks like this, and I set the binding source up here, the source object that makes up the binding is going to be accessible down this entire tree. If I set it right here, it's going to be accessible here. But will these controls up here have access to it? The answer is no. So think of binding as accessible to, on the control that you set it in, and then down its visual tree. When you hear me say visual tree, I want to make sure you understand what I'm talking about. We'll talk about namespaces a little later. So binding, this is the big animal that we want to talk about, right? Everything in XAML, Peter, we started at about 9:30, right? 9:15, 9:30? Okay, I just want to make sure. All right, so then we'll go to 10:30 on this one. That's good. The concept of everything binds is a little hard for some people to get their head around, because when you start comparing it to Windows Forms or web forms, it's very, very different. Windows Forms had this thing called a binding source component. Everybody remember the binding source? Yes, no, what, huh? Yeah, all right. So a binding source, you know, you drop on the binding source onto the form and you bind the binding source to an object. And now certain controls can bind to the binding source only with certain properties. So the binding was very specific to specific controls. Not every control was bindable, and to specific properties of that control. Not everything in a bindable control was bindable. That gets completely thrown out, and the web was even more limiting. In the web, you really had to know what is bindable and what is not, because inherently HTML does not bind. We get binding in the web because we have ASP.NET on top of it. So web forms have binding capability that we programmed into it. Did you ever notice that every technology that comes out for the web is basically a hack to fix a previous deficiency? Seriously. I mean, think about that. Classic ASP, you know, came out so we can dynamically create code that we couldn't write easily in HTML because we needed a server trip, and CGI was just a pain in the butt that nobody wanted to use. But then we had this whole problem of postbacking and losing information. We have to use query string a lot. So the ASP.NET came out with ViewState, right? So ViewState was a big animal. It was overused. So now we came out with other ways of storing stuff besides ViewState. And then all that was overused. So they came out with MVC and then told the rest of the world that web forms suck, which they don't. So now, you know, we got MVC using ASPX, but it's got a lot of limitations. So we didn't have the view engine. That's what Razor is. So everything just seems to be, and then once we figured that these server trips are great, they let us do a lot of stuff, but you're doing way too many of them. Let's stay back in the client again. So introduction to AJAX. So everything seems to be a hack to fix a previous deficiency. In XAML technologies, the answer to what property of what control can I use in binding is yes, anyone you want. You can bind any property of a control to a data source. You can bind the value of this property to another property of that or another control on that same view, and I'm going to give you a demo of this. I mean, you can do a lot of really, really cool binding things with XAML. And when I get into talking about MVVM, the one thing that I want to plant a seed in your head with now is programming WPF with MVVM is about using binding. After you get done with today's sessions, try to never, ever, I mean, I'm really big on not wanting to use absolutes. I rarely will say always do things this way or never do this, because this is programming and there's 1,000 roads to achieving a task, and everybody's got a personal style and footprint for programming. It's a very personal art. It really is. But when you use this technology correctly, especially with MVVM pattern, you never want to find yourself staying in a code behind of a page, text box 1.text equals. Setting a property programmatically like that should not be something that you should ever need to do. You should always resort to doing it in binding. If you find yourself, anybody that can tell me, oh, no, I still need to do this, hit me with that challenge, and I'll show you a way that you'll be able to do it with binding, as long as you're using MVVM correctly. Because MVVM, a view model, becomes your source of binding for the view, and everything is state-driven. There's that state-driven development thing. So we'll talk about that as we get to it. Now, the way binding works in XAML is, unlike Windows Forms or Web Forms, where you got the specific data source property that we had to give specific controls, the grid in WinForms has a data source property. The grid and details view in Web Forms has a data source property. But not every control does. Does the text box have a data source property in either WinForms or Web? If it does, I haven't seen one. Well, the way it works in XAML is that we have this data context property. And remember I told you that every property and every control has a commonality called dependency property. Well, every control in XAML has got some a common backing called framework UI element. And that's where this property comes from, giving binding capability to each and every control that you can possibly drop on a XAML page. So everything has the ability to set a data context. I'm going to talk about this interface a little later. I'm not going to talk about it now. Let's stop talking, period, and just jump right to the code. I'm even going to close this up. I'm going to close up Peter's ugly mug here. We don't need to see you anymore, right? And let's go over here. Now, this is my first WPF application. I told you I didn't have any pre-canned code. I sort of lied because I don't have pre-canned code, but I have a pre-canned project. I created a new project. Big deal. This is exactly what it looks like when you say, give me a new WPF application. The first thing that I want to introduce the people that are really new to WPF is how startup works, because if you're used to Windows Forms, you get this static main class that kicks off the first Windows Forms, your startup object. I just want to show you what the difference is here, because it's already XAML-based. We dive into the world of XAML right away. Every new application has got this app.xaml file. And if you look in the app.xaml file, and I'm not going to get into what else can you put in app.xaml, because it's a pretty extensive conversation. Is that font big enough? I know Peterson's pretty blind in the back, so can you see that? All right. Can I drop it down a couple of pixels so I can fit more?
Yes.
You'd leave it there? Okay. All right. So as you can see in the app.xaml file, I got this startup URI. And that tells me what my startup window is going to be. So now I sure as hell better have this window in existence. And I do. It's here already. It's called mainwindow.xaml. Now, this is what a window looks like. Let's call it what it is. Call it a view. This is what a view looks like when you first create it. And like I told you, it always starts out with a top-level panel. Now, everything on this page has a corresponding object in the code behind, including the window itself, which is referred to as this. No different than a regular Windows form, where you can say this.something, and you're talking about the form itself. Well, the same thing with window. There's the pointer to the code behind class, which we're going to be using in this demo, but we're going to get out of it little by little when we get into the MVVM demos. So here's my first grid. So the first thing that I want to show you is typical drag and drop. Let's look at how drag and drop looks like on here. And yes, two XAML files. Okay, so the question is, what's the purpose of having two XAML files? Okay, first of all, every view is going to be an individual XAML file. So the more windows or user controls I create, I'm going to have a XAML file for each one of them. The special one is this AppXAML. This is an application-wide one. This is one where you put, in the XAML, you put application-wide resources. Think of it as, are you a web developer or a Windows developer? Windows, okay, so I can't hit you with the cascading style sheets analogy, because I can put a bunch of styles here that are kind of analogous to CSS for the web guys, and they'll be available to every page. Well, I can put resources in here. Resources can be styles. They can be templates, data templates, which we're going to get into later on significantly. They can be all sorts of things. The idea is that they're available to every view on this application. So that's a special thing about this. The code behind for this file is also special, because the code behind lets you tap into events that are also application-wide. And if you do an override, you see that I can override on startup. And now I can put code in here that gets programmatically executed when the application starts up. So the AppXAML is the one that's a very special file. If you remove AppXAML out of the picture, the answer to your question is why more than one XAML file is because every view is represented by a XAML file. Does that answer your question? All right, so I'm gonna drop a couple of controls on here, and I'm gonna show you what happens here. Let's drop a label right there, and then let's drop a text box right next to it, and position it. What? My grid came with the window. There's my grid right there. You see it? Yep. That came with the window automatically. Now, I just dropped two things on here, and in fact, I'm going to drop another label in another text box, and I want you to see this. I'm going to drop this label right here, and I'm going to drop this text box right here. Now, so far, we're getting almost the same effect that we do with Windows Forms. Where I dragged and dropped them, that's where they stay. But the reasons are very different, and it's actually not the correct way of doing things. So I'm going to move into the correct way little by little, but I'm going to show you why they're staying like this. This is something called marginal positioning. And all XAML controls have the ability, and when I say all, I'm literally talking about every one of them. Every control in XAML you're going to find has a property called margin. And that property will define the margin from its content area that the control sits on. So the reason that these labels and text boxes have stayed in this grid, and by default, this grid with no additional definition has how many rows and columns? One and one. And they don't have to be referred to explicitly because it's implied. One row, one column. So I have a one row, one column grid here, or table, whatever you want to think of it as, with some controls in it. The reason that this control stays exactly where it is because the margin for this control is set this way. And this starts on the left, and it goes clockwise. And you will mess that one up. I still do. So just don't try to memorize which number is what. Just remember, it starts on the left, and it goes clockwise. So it's left, top, right, bottom. So what this is saying is that this label is 116 points from the left of its containing panel, and it's 34 from the top. And then once you got the 34 from the top, if you got a width on the label, which I believe this one does, actually, it doesn't. So it's a content signify the width. You don't need to put a right and a bottom margin. Now, this isn't really the correct way of doing this. This is not the correct way of using margins, because you do want to use margins, but not for this kind of positioning. If I position controls this way on the form, then the order of the control means nothing. So if I put this text box down here, as you can see, the order of the markup does not affect how it gets positioned on the screen, because it's using marginal positioning. Make sense? Now, I'm going to take these controls, and I'm going to position them correctly. But watch what happens. Before I position them correctly, watch what happens the second that I get rid of the marginal positioning. With no marginal positioning, every control's margin is set to 0. 0, 0, 0, 0 on all four values, which means it's 0 from the left, 0 from the top, which means every control is right on top of each other. And as you can see, it hides everything, right? So this is where we start to have to really predefine the grid. And it's a little more work, but there's a method to this madness, because what happens is that we start laying controls out, and the grid can grow dynamically now, which means we can insert stuff in a row and things get moved down, as opposed to if we had a bunch of controls and we needed to put one in the middle, we need to grab the controls and change all the margins so that they all get moved down. And when I start programming grids now with star and auto as values for the columns or row heights or column width, you're going to see where the real power is, because it's just like tables. You can now set percentages where this column can be 50%, this one can be 50%, or you can set a bunch of rows that are set height, and then the last row is all the remaining height. Or you can set one row to auto. Auto and star are two different things. Star means all the remaining space. Auto means however much space I need to hold its content, meaning it will grow dynamically. And you can't do any of that dynamic growth stuff if you use marginal positioning, which is very, very absolute. This is kind of similar to absolute and relative positioning if you're a CSS guy. Is that John? No, Alex. That's Alex, right? No. You're not Alex, right? No, the guy that just turned his face. Yeah. I was trying to recognize you. I thought you were Alex. No, he looks like Alex Hunk, who comes to the group all the time. I should have recognized. I apologize, man. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to position these two labels and two text boxes in two different rows, one column each. So it's going to be two columns and two rows, okay? So the way we do this with the grid is by predefining column definitions. And if this is called column definitions, how do you think I do rows? For a prize. There you go. You still didn't yell out. Okay, so now I'm going to say column definition, and the first column is going to have a width of 200, and the next column is going to have a width of star. Now I don't have any leftover space. The first one's going to be a width of 200, the next one's going to be whatever the leftover space is, and take a look at what, can everybody see the line that was placed on the screen? Okay, now watch what happens when I resize this form, thus resizing the grid inside of it. Let me bring it here. You see? I can resize the form, and we have a fixed 200 point column, and then we have whatever the remaining space is. And that remaining space is the one that's growing dynamically. The reason it's disappearing when I click on here is because I want to click away from the grid. Otherwise, I can really screw things up because now I'm sizing the grid actually larger than the window. So I want to size the window itself instead of the grid. Now let's create two rows. For the row, it's going to be height, we'll say height equals 30. We'll do three rows because the third one, now take a look at what it looks like now, right? Now watch the minute that I change this to star. That's because the third row now went completely on the remaining space. Now, in order to fit these things, what I got to do is tell it exactly where is it going to go. And we do this with something called an attached property. Attached properties are properties that belong to another control but can affect the appearance or the behavior of the control that you're in. So the label itself does not have a property called row or column or grid row or grid column. However, the grid defines an attached property called row and column that can be used to signify to another control where I want you to reside in relative to me, relative to that grid. And you'll see this concept of attached properties quite a bit as you develop XAML applications, and you can recognize it by the dot notation in a property. So in this case, I'm saying the column equals 0, and the row equals 0. Now, let's go over to the other label, and that label is going to go right under it, which means it's going to be the same column, but row 1. And you see how I just moved over? Now I'm going to go to the text box here, and which text box is with which? It doesn't matter, but text box 1 is the one on the bottom. So now I can tell it here and here. And what did I do wrong? Oh, here we go. There we go. Now take a look at the grid. As you can you see the lines on the second text box? Yeah, you can see them there better than on my screen. Now you can see there's two labels and two text boxes and they're positioned in the right place. And if we were dealing with controls that grow dynamic in size, like perhaps a list box or a grid or something like that, we don't have to worry about marginal positioning because now if we were to place a grid in a row that's auto height, that row will grow dynamically as the grid content grow. And we can tell it details like the maximum height. We may not want it to grow dynamically till 1,000 rows. We want it to stop at 20 rows before it shows its scroll bar. So you have a lot finer control, more polished control over the stuff that you put on the screen. Now we can still add marginal if we wanted to. So if I wanted to in these text boxes, I can do the following. I can now say margin equals from the top three, no, I'm sorry, from the left five, from the top three, from the right zero, and from the bottom three. And do the same thing for the other text box. Look what just happened to that text box. So you see margins are still going to come in handy if you want that really nice fine-tuned positioning. Because now not only did I tell it what grid and row I want this stuff to go on, but I could also offset it just a little bit so it doesn't sit right on top of the previous one. So you'll still be using margining here and there. There's another property of interest called padding, which for those of you guys that are web developers, you know cell padding and cell margining on table. It works exactly the same way. Margining is the space outside of the control relative to its content. Padding is the space inside of the control relative to the content of that control. You actually have that level of control over this detail. Everybody with me so far? Yeah. Because we're developers, everything's null-based, dude. Always. Yep. Yeah. I think everything in the world of software has been zero since the days of Alan Cooper. Yeah, everything's not. I mean, when I play racquetball, I used to say no versus no with my friends instead of zero, zero, you know? Yeah, everything is zero-based. I think VB tried the one-based stuff, and it wasn't too successful because everybody else decided to stick with zero. Bless you. Yes, sir? Say that again? No, there's not. I'm going to talk about binding now, but there was not. The question is, was there an implied binding between the grid and the window? No, there isn't, but there's an implied relationship because so far I've built a very simple, trivial, non-exciting screen. However, bless you, if you've noticed, I built a visual tree. So the relationship here is that the grid is part of the window's visual tree, not the other way around. The controls, the labels, and the text boxes are part of the grid's visual tree. They're also part of the window because the hierarchy starts. So the visual tree is very visual when you're looking at the hierarchy of the XAML. That's the only relationship I've implied so far. It's just a visual tree relationship. Now, I want to show you something about content here because this is going to get pretty cool. Watch this. I got one more row in there, right? So let's put another control in here. I'm going to say list box. And this list box is going to grow and go in column 0, and it's going to go in row 1, zero, 1, 2, so row 2, the last one. And I want it to span both columns. I don't want to stick it in column 0 only. So we have another attached property here, if I can type, called column span. And now the list box is going to span both columns. This works the same way that it does on the, like it does on the web. Now, this is where it gets a little interesting. Now, the list box, by default, has a collection of what's called list box items. Now, I'm gonna later do binding on this, but right now, I'm going to show you how to do a manual one. Now, here's a manual list box item. I can put in here a text block whose text property, which is just a shortcut for binding, is Miguel was here. And if I bring this down, look what it looks like. I got a list box item, right? Now, let's put another list box item. That says, and here too. As you can see, pretty, still kind of boring, right? But here's a list box. There's the list box tickers, as you can see around the tick marks. And here's the two items. Now, I told you earlier that a content can be anything, right? So if I wanted to say, if I wanted to add another list box item and make that list box item, two pieces of text. Let's say two pieces of text on top of each other. I couldn't just put two text blocks, and this is an important point. Every element content can only be one thing unless it's designed specifically to hold more than one thing. And the only things that are designed to hold more than one thing are panels. So if I wanted to put two pieces of text on top of each other, I just can't say Miguel was here and here too, right there, because it's going to give me an error. I have to put some kind of panel that will allow me to lay that information, that content out the way I want to lay it out. Now, an easy way to do it would just be to put a stack panel here, orientation equals vertical, and now I can put two text blocks, item 1 and item 2. And as you can see, these, see the tick marks around it? That's one item, but it has all sorts of funky content in it. If I wanted to, I can say I just tag a circle, stack the circle, and two text blocks. I can do that horizontally if I want. So the amount of control that you get here is quite extensive. Yeah. I'm going to show you that in a second, man. Jump in the gun, dude. You jump in the gun. I want you to take a look at how the selected index works. You see? It's still an item. In fact, if I put this back as vertical right here, it's going to be the behavior that you expect. Because that third item, even though it looks like it's three things, it's still one item. See how that works? Now, what this gentleman here is talking about is, can I do something really, really funky? And the answer is absolutely. You can funketize this however you want. I can take a copy of this entire grid and make that a single list item right in here. And that's exactly what I'll get. And if I wanted to, I can do, here, let's do this. Watch this. This will get kind of nice and recursive because recursion is like super cool, right? Just leave it like this. Only this one, I'll change it to horizontal. Let's see what this looks like. Here's one item. Here's another item. Here's the third item. Here's the fourth item. But this fourth item, that's clickable content because it's a list box. And you get the concept now of that strict separation between appearance and behavior? It still behaves exactly like you expect it to behave, even if it looks like absolute crap and has no productive value whatsoever. But it makes for a really cool demo, doesn't it? Yes, sir. That's a very good point. I try not to use any XAML that I'm not going to need because it's just excessive stuff on the screen. Unless I need to refer to those controls from the code behind, I will not name them. They don't require a name, unlike Windows Forms, which usually requires a name. Now, watch this. Let me see if I can do this from scratch. Let me see if I remember how to do this from scratch. I'm going to take this list box right here. And say, Peter, help me out. Let me see if I remember how to do this. There we go. Hold on. Shoot. Here we go. Hold on. How's that? I just rotated that last item 45 degrees. There it is right there. Now, does it still work if I click inside? Yeah. See? It's pretty wild, isn't it? Now, I don't want to see a bunch of applications that look like this start showing up on the web, but it's kind of cool to play with, right? You can come up with some really, really slick stuff. You really can. You can add rounded borders, and you can add shading and all sorts of funky things. I can use another render transform called a skew transform, and if I do a skew transform, things will get really, you got to really smoke a bung full of Fruit Loops to understand what the hell's going to go on the screen here in a second. Watch this. What's the skew transform? Angle X and angle Y. So we'll just say angle X is 45, and I have no idea what I'm doing at this point. I'm totally winging it. But we'll just say 24 here, and let's see what this looks like. There. But you see how it took it and it went, and it kind of skewed it? However, once again, the behavior is exactly what you expect. There's the clicking on the fourth item, and the fourth item has got its own click. You see that? The possibilities are endless, aren't they? All right, let's stop screwing around and let's get into some binding stuff because we want to finish by 10:30 and we got exactly about 20 minutes, okay? So, everybody with me so far? Think it's kind of cool? Yes, sir.
The control that you're building right now, you're building them using the IntelliSense. Could you drag a control onto the form, click on it, see its properties?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I've gotten used to programming this way, and I actually like it better. I like the control. The Visual Studio Designer, in 2008, it was pretty buggy. In 2010, it got significantly better. I mean, when I say significantly, like tenfold better. It's really good. To me, it's still a little easier to just program in XAML, because I'm used to visualizing the tree now. So I tend to stay in XAML, but to answer your question, I can click right. Let's try to see. This is why I don't like to do it. And now trying to focus in on that list box is going to be hard, because now I'm at the item level, so I can't get my mouse. There we go. Now I just got to the list box. Then I can go to properties, and there's all my properties. But once you start doing panels within panels, it's just like HTML. Have you guys noticed when you program ASP.NET, sometimes it's easier to just stay in the code because it's hard to click right on that cell that you're looking for. XAML's no different. Sir? Well, that's true only in the case of the grid, because unlike HTML, where you set up tables, then TRs, and then within TRs you got TDs. The row and column definition in an HTML table is more visually hierarchic, right? If that's even a word. But in the XAML grid, it's a little different because you predefine your grid and column row definitions and you use attached properties. So that's a feature of just the way the grid works. I don't understand the question that you're asking. Yeah. Just in the case of the grid. The only place that I'm doing it is in the case, because that's just the way the grid works. Behind that? Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I think they flipped a coin in Redmond. They did. I mean, I really don't know. I don't know what they were thinking when they decided to do it this way. I'm guessing that the reason they did it is because they came up with this concept of attached properties, and it's just easier to predefine your stuff on top and then use attached properties, so that now with the concept of attached properties, the grid row and grid column can apply to anything that's inside of it. So it's just a different way of doing it, that's all. I mean, why they did it that way as opposed to, like, HTML, I really don't know. Probably because these guys hate the web, just like web guys hate the Windows, so they decided to do it differently. Do you have one more question? No, there is not. And it is a debate, and it's a stupid debate, because CSS is great and tables are great, and each one still has their place. And a good application is usually going to have a small combination of both. I dislike applications that are nothing but div tags as much as I despise applications that are nothing but tables with no CSS. I think there's got to be a marriage between the two to get an application done just right and to make it maintainable, okay? If you look at DOSBlog, the DOSBlog engine, which is what my blog uses, DOSBlog uses tables for the general layout. Like, here's your first column, here's your other column, your heading, and your body area, and a footer. There's a table that defines that. Now, within those certain areas, it's all CSS-driven. I think that's a really nice marriage between the two technologies. With XAML, you don't have that. You have either marginal positioning, or you have the positioning that I did with the grid, and I did a combination of marginal positioning with the absolute positioning there. That's what you have. As far as styling is concerned, you do have CSS-style styling, where I can say, make every text box in my application look like this, and it applies to all of them. But I can say, for this text box, I don't know, maybe I can. I've never tried it before. I may be able to give a style, marginal information, and then apply that to a text box and see if it works. I may be able to do that. We can try it later. But I haven't seen that very much. I usually see that for styling only. Well, the width and margin are two different things. The width and margin are two different. I mean, it is going to kind of override it. If I don't put a width, the control is going to go, and span all the way to the size of the content. It's, I wouldn't call it really an override because it doesn't override the left or the top. It just kind of overrides the right. It doesn't override the left, top, or bottom, just the right margin. If you don't put a width, then it goes all the way to the right margin. If you do put a width, then it ignores the right margin, and it makes the width absolute. So it's going to take a little playing. I mean, it's XAML positioning can get a little frustrating. Hopefully with time, Seth can show you the DevExpress layout control, which helps you a lot with positioning stuff on the screen. So, all right, we got to continue, okay? So, oh, I usually do. I apologize. Okay, all right. All right, so we're going to do a little bit of binding here, okay? And what I want to do for binding is that I want to let's create an object here, and this object is going to be called Avenger, because I know this movie's still kind of being made, and they're prepping the scene for the Avengers movie by coming out with all these different movies, right? We've seen Iron Man, and we've seen the Hulk. Now we're going to see Thor next. Have you seen the previews for Captain America? That's going to be pretty hot. And then eventually working on an Avengers movie. So let's create a property here for this Avenger object called Hero Name. And we'll have one property called power, like what can this guy do, okay? And now let's create another class, and this class is going to be called Avengers. And Avengers is going to inherit from list of Avenger. And it's not going to have any constructor, but it's going to collect the list of Avengers, and I'll put just a hard-coded list. So let's suspend this belief and assume that this is loading in from the database. I'll just say load. Okay, and we'll say Avengers list equals new Avengers. We're going to return that list, and we're going to add to it new Avenger. And this guy's going to be, right here. Okay, the hero name. So we'll start with the first one that they did. Which one was the first one? Iron Man, right? We won't put secret identity. And what is his power? Prosthetic. What is that, what he called it in Iron Man 2? I basically have a glorified prosthetic or something like that. All right. And that should be it. And let's add just a, hold on a second. What am I missing here? One of these? No. What am I missing? Oh, they're right. That's cool. So why is it telling me that this? Oh, yeah. Actually, that's it. Okay, so let's add a couple of more here. And the next hero that we had was the Hulk. And the next hero will be Thor. You don't want to know what I was going to do before I found out this was being recorded. I wasn't going to use Avengers. I'm going to use something a little more risque. And this one's going to be Captain America. And let's see. The Hulk has... What is his power? He's just big and dumb. Is that how you spell dumb? I am dumb. How do you spell dumb? Is that it? Okay. What is Thor's power? He's got a Home Depot appliance. And Captain America seems to have a plastic frisbee. Does that make sense? Okay, so now we have the ability of having one Avenger or a list of Avengers, okay? So what we're going to do here is that we're going to come over to the code behind of the window, and we're going to incorporate these two things here, okay? What we're going to do is that we're going to create, we're going to take this label, and we're going to make this label hero name, and we're going to make this label power. And then we're going to put one Avenger inside this text box. That's the first example that we're going to do, okay? So let's go over to the code behind. And we'll just do it right in the constructor. We'll make it as easy as possible. What?
Okay.
We'll make it as easy as possible. can't type standing up very well. And we're going to say hero name equals, and we'll just reproduce Iron Man here. No, I'm actually fine. Thank you. And somebody said money. We'll just use that. There we go. Yeah, Tony Stark was pretty filthy rich, wasn't he? You know, I've been to the top of that dune. It's called Point Doom. It's in Malibu, where they superimpose the CGI of Tony Stark's house, which is a pretty awesome house, right? I tweeted. If you look back at my Twitter history, I said, who the hell put a Starbucks where Tony Stark's house would be? Because there's an actual little strip mall up there. Right before you get to the top of the dune, there's a strip mall with a Starbucks and a little mini mart in it. All right, so we got one Avenger here. Now, here's what we want to do, okay? For simple data binding, I told you every control has a data. We may go 5 minutes over, so we're going to go about 10:35. Is that okay with you guys? So every control has this data context property. And when I say every control, I literally mean everything, starting with, and you know what? I'm going to go XAML only here. Starting with the top-level control, which is the window. So the window has a data context. The grid has a data context. The label has a data context. I can just bind that one thing if I wanted to. The binding is not about binding that one control. It's about binding the control and its visual tree. So if I wanted to use this object in my form, I can bind it to anything that is at the level where I want to use the properties or above. So in this case, I'm going to make it really, really simple first. And I'm just going to say this.dataContext equals Avenger. And that's it. I've just set my data source. What I've done is that I have programmatically set the data source of this tag, because this is window, this is the this tag, to the Avenger object. Now, once I set that, the properties of the object to which I have bound are now accessible for binding from that point on and throughout the visual tree until I change it otherwise, if I do change it otherwise. Does that make sense? So now the question is, how do I use this binding information? Well, if I go to the text boxes, let's go over to the text boxes and bring them into view where we can see them a little better. And the text boxes should have a text property somewhere or a content property. And they don't. I mean, they're empty. They don't have anything. So let's just put a text property on here. So this is the property that I want to bind. And the binding is really, really easy. All you got to do is say binding, space, and the name of a property that will hopefully be found in whatever object I bound to that level of the visual tree or above. And I did because I bound all the way at the top of the visual tree, which is the window level. So now I can just say, what did I call it, hero name? And the other text box is going to say text equals binding power. Now, the coupling here is extremely loose. There is no compile time checking, okay? So you just got to keep that in mind. If it doesn't know what I'm binding to because it's done at runtime. Remember, I just did it. I did it in the code behind, and that's not executed until runtime. So it has no idea what I'm binding to. It's going to compile just fine. And even at runtime, if it tries to look for a property in the underlying object and it doesn't find it, it just ignores it. So you're going to just get an empty value. The only time you'll get an error is if you're, let's say, for example, that the property power, let's say hero name had it was an object instead of a string. It was a real object. And that object had first name and last name in it. Well, I can certainly do something like this. That would work too. And if hero name either didn't exist or was set to null, then that would blow up with your conventional object reference not set because hero name would be null. So it can be a little misleading because of the lack of compile time checking here. But let's see if this runs. There we go. And I did it backwards. Did I do it backwards? Oh, yeah, because I moved the boxes around, remember? Yep, I moved the boxes around. So let's change this to hero name, and let's change this one to power. And there we go. As simple as that. In its simplest form, that's how data binding works. It's very, very simple. Now, watch this. I want to set these text boxes, right? So what's the parent? What's the direct parent of this text box? It's the grid. Where did I set my data context? At the window level. So somebody asked me about the name property. Who is that? Okay, now, I can't address this grid from the code behind because it's not named. Now I can address it from the code behind. So if I'm not going to do it, I leave the name out just because it's more crap to look at that I'm not going to use. But now I can go into the code behind and look what I can do. Now, is this going to work?
Yes.
It should work exactly the same, no different. The difference is that if I wanted to put controls now outside of the grid but inside the window, they are not going to be subject to the same data binding off the same object because they're now not within that visual tree. But so long as I stay within the visual tree of grid one, the data context is still going to flow all the way through. Pretty cool? All right. Yeah. The question was, do I have any good tips for inspecting the data context? Besides conventional debugging? Not really. I mean, it really is just comes down to debugging. Unfortunately, there is no way to troubleshoot XAML with a debugger. You'd have to put a breakpoint somewhere. Like, for example, if I wanted to see what the data context is of my form, I can put a button, stick a button in here that just goes through a click event and do a break, you know, systemdebugger.break or systemdiagnostics.break, and then inspect the data context property by different controls to see which one of them is set. So there's no real good way of doing it. Here's a piece of good news and a piece of bad news. Silverlight 5, which I expect, Peter, we will receive bits on probably sometime around Mix. It will be available to the rest of the public. Well, forget the rest of the public. I'm an MVP, and it's not available to me yet. They're being so hush-hush with Silverlight 5, it's pathetic. But Silverlight 5 will add something that – who's a Silverlight developer here? Okay, you guys are going to love this, XAML debugging. Breakpoints in XAML, where you can actually inspect – you can put a breakpoint on a piece of XAML and inspect tags and bindings right from there. How cool is that? Is that something you look forward to? WPF ain't getting it right away.
Yeah.
Huh? No, sir, and it will not be available in WPF upon the release of Silverlight 5. I'm expecting, we're all expecting it to be available in WPF upon the next release of WPF, whether it's .NET 4.5 or .NET 5 or whatever numeric sequence they decide to make up this time. But it's going to be available in Silverlight 5, and it was demoed in a Firestarter a couple of months ago by Scott Guthrie, and it looks fantastic. I mean, put a breakpoint right there on your XAML and have it stop and then look into it. A beautiful thing, and I want to go and just take a shotgun to somebody for not putting it into the WPF right away because I really want that capability. And technologically speaking, I don't see a reason why we can't have it, but I think it has to do with just a release cycle. You're talking about when you hover over. Yeah, right. Yeah, the little magnifying glass. Yeah, you can do that for any object. And that's actually a pretty cool thing. And you can anchor it. You can anchor it on the code. Yeah. All right, let's do one more thing, okay? We got like 5 minutes left, and I want to show you one more thing that's actually very, very cool. I want to take this entire list box here and get rid of all that junk, because now I want this list box to show my list of Avengers. And how many did I have? Like 4, right? So I want the list box to show it. So I want to show it to you in a data-bound way, okay? And it's easier than you think to do a data-bound list box, much easier than you think. The first thing you want to do is you set up your list box, but instead of creating a bunch of manual list items, which rarely we will ever do because everything is going to be data bound, what I'm going to do is tell the list box, tell the list box what its item source is going to be. What's the list box item source is going to be? Not item source, I'm sorry. It's going to be item template. Here, I'll show you the difference in a second because item source is just a different property that's used for something else. I'm going to redefine the item template. Okay, every control in WPF and Silverlight is made up of different templates. Some controls have more templates than others. In the case of a button, the button has a main template that defines how that button looks. And you can actually alter that template. So now you can define every little detail about a button. I tend to alter the text box template a lot, so I can change the text box border to a slightly rounded border, so all my text box show up a little different. Every control can be very, very finely tuned. The list box can be finely tuned as well, not only in its border, but in its content area. And the content area template of a list box is referred to as the item template. I'm going to show you two templates here, but the first one's the easy one, okay, the cool one. That's the item template. Now I'm about to redefine your content area. What do I want to redefine it with? And the answer is I want to redefine it with a data template. And now, even though this looks a little cryptic to you, this is a cookie-cutter pattern. Once you have this, the next thing that goes in here is anything you want to represent a single list box item. So if I were to take my grid now, I'm going to leave it as grid one. That's perfectly fine. And say the following. Avengers list equals Avengers load. That's going to load up those four, right? Now I'm going to set the data context of the grid. You know what? Let's go back to the data context of the form. I'm going to set it to list. Okay? Now I have actually... Let's do this. Let's leave this one like this. And let's add a name for the list box right here called LST1. Now I can say, because remember I told you the data context flows down the visual tree until I change it, if I change it. Well, I'm about to change it. Because I'm about to say list1 data context equals list. So now the Avenger, single Avenger data context is going to flow from the grid all the way down the visual tree until it gets to the list box, because at that point, the data context has changed to something else. That allows me to continue using these two bindings without breaking them, and now I'm going to go to the list box, and now the list box data context has been changed, and it's what? The entire list of Avengers. What is contained inside the list of Avengers? Avenger object, right? And each Avenger object has a hero name and a power, right? So now I'm going to define the template that represents one item, and that's going to be repeated however many times are in the collection. To bind the collection, I got to do this. I already set the data context, but I got to tell it what part of that data context, because that data context can be a whole elaborate object model, and maybe only one of those properties is the collection property that signifies the items in my list box. Does that statement make sense? Now, in this case, the actual data context that I bound is the entire list of items. So what I got to do is that I got to tell it item source equal just plain binding. And I have to do this step. If my object was an object called Miguel's data source, and one of those properties of that object was called Avengers and it was a collection, then if the list box is bound to Miguel's data source, the binding would say Avengers. You understand? But since the data context is the actual collection, it's kind of like saying this. I'm just going to say the item source is the binding itself, the data context itself. Now I can define how I want this to look. And I'm going to say stack panel orientation is vertical. And the first thing I'm going to do is that I'm going to put a text block here whose content equals the hero name. And now underneath that vertically stacked stack panel, I'm going to put another one that is horizontal. And that one is going to have a couple of spaces. Power and font style is italic. And now this entire little data template represents one of those items, and since it's going to be repeated due to the binding, this is what we should get. See? not too complicated, is it? It's a pretty simple cookie cutter pattern to follow. When you start seeing all this, these list boxes that have this weird content inside with maybe an icon, a picture, and then some text, and maybe something else, maybe some shape, that's all it is. It's just a custom data template whose internal content is a combination of panels and controls to make, to represent that one item. And then that data template is repeated X number of times. Now, the last one that I want to show you is there's another template that's available in the list box. A list box is designed to show a list of these items, right? Now, no matter what this content is, what's the one common thing that you have seen so far in the list box? Every item is stacked on top of each other. Doesn't matter what each item looks like, they're stacked on top of each other. That tells you that somewhere in there, somebody told the list box, use a stack panel, vertically stacked stack panel, to display your content, despite what the specific content template is set to. Well, you can change that too, because there's another template called items panel. Is it items panel? Yeah. And you say items panel template. And here, I can just redefine this to say horizontal. And now I just redefine what kind of panel is going to be used to stack the items inside this box. So each item is going to look just like I designed it, but now what's going to happen is that they're going to be stacked horizontally. And the behavior is still the same. You see? It just happens to be shifted horizontally instead of vertically. Now, why is this important? Well, before we cut for a 15-minute break, I'll show you something that was not written by me, but it's a really, really cool demo. And you need to, you got to at least just see it real quick. Absolutely. I'll make it available. I'm making all my stuff available. As far as the demo that I'm showing you, yeah, I found it on the web. It was written by, I forgot her name, but it was written by a lady who was the actual lead architect in charge of data binding for XAML. So she's the one that designed this entire thing. And what you're going to see here is an object that represents the name of a planet, its orbit, the diameter of the orbit, an image, a URL for an image, some details about it. And then you got this collection called Solar System, which is a collection of these planets. As you can see, there's, how many are there? Is she acknowledging Pluto or not? 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay, so there's 11 planets. So I think the lady made up a couple of planets. Yeah, I still acknowledge Pluto. I'm old school. Besides, I love Disney. So we got this data, right? It's just nothing but data that contains information about this, right? What she did is that she redefined the list box so that the items template is a custom canvas that is designed to work off kind of an elliptical display. Instead of a horizontal or a vertical stack panel, it's more of an elliptical kind of panel. And then she defined the data template so that it can position her data accordingly. And the end result is this. And then she just bound the two. This is nothing but a list box. That's all it is. It's a list box with each clickable item represented as a planet. And all the data within the object objects that are bound is determining how the data template looks. And the items template is redefined to appear as a quarter circle, a quarter ellipse. But at the end of the day, it's just the list box. I can use the exact same list box and bind it to my own information. It'll just show weird stuff. But there's no real fanciness here beyond the fact that it's just a list box, a redefined list box. So the power is pretty amazing, and it still works and looks like a regular list box. In fact, I should be able to, okay, she took off multiple select. If she wouldn't have turned it off, I should be able to hold the shift key down and select a bunch of planets just like I would in any other list box. Pretty slick? All right, now, the data context and stuff at the binding is going to be very important for you for the next couple of sessions, okay? The one piece of information that I didn't tell you and that I'll explain later is that the binding by default is only going to occur in one direction. There's a little something you got to do in order for the binding to be dual direction, and that's where the iNotify property change interface comes in. Let's take a break, and then we'll continue with MBVM, all right?